Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. China is, of course, the most significant challenge we face to the country we love. It is a place that has been pursuing under the Chinese Communist Party a relentless, unrestricted war against our nation, and I think it's fair to say the free world more generally, which it seeks to dominate. There are few people in America who have studied longer, more thoughtfully, and more impactfully what the Chinese communists are up to than our first guest. His name is Stephen Mosier. He was the first Western social scientist admitted into communist China as a result of some high-level interventions, and as a result, had eyes on from fairly early on the nature of this barbaric transnational criminal organization, the Communist Party of China, and has been warning about it ever since. He is the author of a number of important books, including Bully of Asia, which pretty perfectly captures what the CCP is. He is a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and was one of three expert panelists on a webinar that we did last week that I'm anxious to talk a little bit further with Steve Mosier about. Steve, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back to Securing America.
Well, it's good to be here with you again, Frank.
You and Dr. Bradley Thayer and Captain Jim Fennell did a three-part harmony that was extraordinarily powerful about the degree to which we now have reason to believe the Chinese Communist Party is no longer content with engaging in so-called unrestricted non-kinetic warfare against us, but is now ready to go into the more traditional violent phase of warfare, perhaps immediately focused on Taiwan, but in the expert opinion of all three of you, very probably involving attacks against American persons, assets, and perhaps territory as well. Talk us through the nature of this threat as you see it at the moment, Steve Mosier.
Well, what has been going on in China since really before the Russian invasion of Ukraine is that the Chinese Communist Party leaders, led, of course, by the supreme leader, Xi Jinping, have been doing detailed strategic, operational, and tactical planning for an invasion of Taiwan. So I think at one level, they see the Russian invasion of Ukraine, where Russia is simply grinding down the Ukrainian forces and will, I think, at the end of the day, barring major intervention from NATO, seize as much Ukrainian territory as it desires to. While that is going on, China has been watching and engaging the reaction of the West at the same time that it has been holding meetings, not at the national level necessarily, but at the provincial level to begin planning for what it calls a people's war. Now, the people's war during the Chinese Civil War was a war in which every person in the red areas, in the communist base areas, was considered to be a resource by Chairman Mao Zedong and by the Red Army. People were forced to serve the purposes of the Communist Party, and women were forced out of the home into the fields, children were forced to labor, and all men were enlisted in the army. Every resource in the red base areas was confiscated, expropriated by the Communist Party. The same thing is happening today in China. Every resource, not just the military resources that we all count, the bean counters count the planes and the tanks and the ships and so forth that have military uses, obviously, that are part of the People's Liberation Army. They're enlisting in this future invasion of Taiwan private commercial vessels, fishing vessels, roll-off ships that carry normally car ferries to get across the Taiwan Strait. So very, very detailed planning for a people's war in the hope, I think, of just while we're distracted with Ukraine, moving into Taiwan in a major way, in an overwhelming way.
One of the things that I was so impressed by was your evaluation of a video from Guangdong province, not the one most immediately in proximity to Taiwan, but a very important one of China, of course. And as I understand it, you did some of your research in Guangdong province. Talk a little bit about this video that purports to be a planning session, as you say, at the provincial level in which the military and top party cadre are preparing to move from what they call normal to war.
Well, what you have here is a detailed planning meeting. It was leaked out of China. Some people questioned its authenticity. I listened to it, Frank, in Chinese. It has, to me, the ring of truth. It is a meeting not just filled with communist exhortations and slogans like a typical political meeting that has been held in China every day for the last 70 years. This was very detailed planning between the senior military leadership of the southern region, the Southern Military Command of China, and the Guangdong Provincial Party officials. And basically, the military was telling the party leaders what they would need from the commercial sector of the economy, from the nominally private sector of the economy when war broke out. And we're talking about identifying factories in Guangdong province that make drones and ensuring that the workers who are making those drones, which can be used to attack Taiwan, would stay on the factory floor in the event of an outbreak by locking them in the factories, forcing them to work long hours, not allowing them to go home at night, ensuring what they called worker stability. The same thing in other factories making ships, the same thing on with regard to the merchant vessels. They were talking in such detailed terms that they identified specific airports, specific railroads, specific railroad cars, specific planes, and, for example, 62 roll-on, roll-off ships, normally that are used to transport automobiles from China, in and out of China, to other countries, can be virtually overnight transformed into a carrier of an armored brigade that would help an armored brigade get across the Taiwan Straits. 62 of those roll-on, roll-off ships, ro-ro ships, they're called, were being expropriated by the Guangdong provincial government and put immediately at the disposal of the military whenever the military asked for it, whenever the go order was given by Xi Jinping.
This is, I guess, what they call the civil-military fusion that is part and parcel of Chinese doctrine. And what you've described, Steve Mosher, is essentially not just an abstraction. This is detailed planning that is being executed as we speak. And as I understand it, the marching orders from Beijing to this province and presumably the others is to be prepared to act on these plans within something like 90 days. So this is potentially a very, very imminent problem indeed. We have to take a brief break. When we come back, Steve Mosher, I want to come back to something that you touched on there a moment ago, essentially slave labor and the extent to which it is not just something that factory workers in the military sector would be subjected to, but that it is endemic, and particularly in the Uyghur areas of China. We'll talk with Stephen Mosher about all of this and much more, and what it means for us and the idea of maintaining the peace in the Western Pacific. That and more straight ahead. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. There may be a worse time for Joe Biden to pay a visit to the Middle East, but it is hard to think of one. The government of Israel has just fallen. Its parliament disbanded in the fifth round of elections in 3 years, called for October. The Biden team has been emboldening the Palestinians to engage in renewed violence. Jordan's kingdom is hanging by a thread, and the likelihood of conflict with Iran seems to be growing by the moment. There is literally no chance that President Biden's presence will improve matters. His team has fostered regional instability by subverting Israel, appeasing Iran's mullahs, and simultaneously undermining Saudi Arabia and asking it to increase oil production. China and Russia are making regional inroads at our expense. It's in the vital interests of the United States for Joe Biden to stay home. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. We are continuing this conversation with Stephen Mosier, one of the members of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, one of our duty experts on matters involving the true character of the bully of Asia, as he calls the Chinese Communist Party, a bully worldwide, increasingly indeed. And Steve, I wanted to just sort of move the lens back a bit and focus in on something that you wrote very powerfully about in the New York Post the other day, in which you talked about all of what's known by the locals as East Turkestan becoming essentially a huge open-air prison camp. This is, of course, where the Uyghur Muslim minority and other ethnic minorities reside and are being brutalized, indeed genocidally, by the Chinese Communist Party. Tell us what's happening to those people now and give us a sense of the scale on which it is taking place, both to them and unfortunately to lots of other Chinese as well.
Well, it's very clear that Xi Jinping, the leader of the Chinese Communist Party, has ordered the genocide of the Uyghur people. They are to be extinguished, not just physically, historically, culturally. Their language is to be extinguished. Their existence as a separate people is to be extinguished. And of course, they're being extinguished in a very practical way because Uyghur women are being aborted and sterilized in large numbers, which is fits the technical definition of genocide, all right? So we have genocide in real time. That's why Mike Pompeo, in his last day in office back in January, a year before, declared that there was genocide being committed by the Chinese Communist Party leaders in what China calls Xinjiang province. Xinjiang, by the way, means new border. So the very name in Chinese is an admission that this is not historically a part of China. It wasn't part of Ming Dynasty China. It was only part of the Manchu Empire. It was independent until 1949, when somehow all of the Uyghur leaders were killed on a trip to Beijing to negotiate their separate existence as a country, and the Red Army moved in and took it over. So this is historically the Turkish people, Turkish-speaking people who live there, have lived there for thousands of years. China is an imperial power, and this is a colony that it is absorbing. And it is absorbing it in a very brutal way right now. For the last few years, they've set up the largest network of gulags, a gulag network, the Laogai network, as we call it in Chinese, in the history of China. And that's saying something, because remember, the Chinese Communist Party is known for its Laogai, is known for its Chinese version of the gulag. Millions of Uyghur men have been sent to this Chinese gulag, the Chinese Laogai, sometimes simply for having a beard that's a little too long because it suggests they may be practicing their Islamic faith, or for sending over their cell phone a greeting in Arabic, which is now illegal and can get you thrown into jail. What happens to the men in the prisons, of course, is that they're immediately tissue typed, blood samples are taken, and if they happen, Frank, to be a tissue match for someone who needs a heart or liver or a kidney, they are executed for their organs. This is forced organ transplantation in China. It's a major business in China. I believe it's a $10 billion a year business. And a lot of the customers come from the Middle East, and they want someone who has had a halal diet. They want someone who's never eaten pork. And guess what? The Uyghur Muslims avoid eating pork. And of course, they are transplant victims for people from the Middle East willing to pay large sums of money for a new heart, new liver, kidney, corneas, you name it.
Unfortunately, some of these are not necessarily halal donors, involuntary donors. Of course, as you know, Steve Mosher, there's Falun Gong practitioners who are being applied for this purpose as well. And it's just unbelievably horrific, but of a piece with the character of the Chinese Communist Party. And I'm fond of saying, Stephen, your research, including that you do, of course, at the Population Research Institute, which you founded, documents this to a fairly well. Any nation that treats its own people this unspeakably is not going to be charitable towards others, that's for sure. Would you talk a little bit about the social credit system and how it is being utilized to take this kind of Orwellian oppression, localized to some extent, as you've just described, but really to the fullest extent of the nation of China?
Well, China has become a high-tech digital dictatorship. The entire country is a prison camp. We talked about the eastern Turkestan, Xinjiang, being a prison camp for the Uyghurs, where they're gradually being extinguished. But in a very real sense, the entire country has had a high-tech electronic fence erected around it, where people are under watch all the time. And, you know, to emphasize the absolute callousness towards human life that the Communist Party has always had in its heart of hearts, I like to quote Chairman Mao Zedong, who said, "It doesn't matter if we kill millions of people, they help to fertilize the ground." Think about that. Human beings regarded as nothing more than perhaps
the most expedient mistreatment of them for the good of the party and its objectives.
So we have in China people being monitored in real time on their cell phones, on their computers. We have people being monitored by surveillance cameras. Of the top 20 cities in the world in terms of number of surveillance cameras per 1,000 people, the top 19 are all Chinese cities. The Chinese people are under watch, under surveillance all the time, and not necessarily by human operators, because that would be too much an investment of labor and time. They're under watch by artificial intelligence, which China is making great advances in, so that in Beijing today, if you jaywalk, the surveillance camera will take a picture of your face, AI will identify you, and the AI will automatically deduct the fine for jaywalking from your bank account without any human intervention necessary.
Right. We talked yesterday with Bill Walton about, I think it was banks in Shanghai that had frozen the accounts of their customers, and they were being subjected to protests. And the social credit system was used by the Chinese to reach out and essentially shut down those protests by changing the health code on their digital cards from green, meaning they were able to move about, to red, meaning that they were not. This would seem to be of a piece with this larger purpose of the Chinese to control absolutely everybody and to crush them if need be by denying them access to food or, you know, education or travel or whatever else, right?
Well, it's interesting. I think that a Communist Party always necessarily has to have an enemy. And it begins with class enemies, but it doesn't stop there. In China, it has moved to ethnic enemies like the Tibetans and the Uyghurs. But it also is now aggressively moving against anyone who has a business that is separate and apart from the government, has opinions that perhaps vary a little bit from the Communist Party opinions propagated by Xi Jinping. Everyone has in China has to download a Xi Jinping Strong China app on their phone and has to study the works of Xi Jinping every day for about 20 minutes. And to make sure they have done their daily homework, they have to answer questions on it. It's sort of like a daily Bible study, except they're not studying the Bible. They're studying the works of Xi Jinping.
The deity of the Chinese Communist Party. Yeah, absolutely. Steve Mosher, we have to leave it at that. I could go on for days with you, and I hope that you'll come back to us again very soon. We so appreciate your expertise and insights and clarity on all of these points. God bless you, my friend, and thanks for the great work you do at the Public Relations Research Institute. Next up, we're going to speak with Cindy Drukier. She is the host of a terrific program on NTD television, The Nation Speaks, a program she's just introduced on COVID-19 is fascinating. We'll talk with her about that more right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and welcome for the first time to a very special guest. Her name is Cindy Drukier. She is a very accomplished journalist, a producer, an editor. She has a television show of her own called The Nation Speaks at NTD.com and EpicTV.com. She is a marvelous raconteur of the kind of information that we all need to have, especially about challenges to our country like the pandemic. And this is the subject of an important new special by Cindy and her team. It is called COVID-19, A Reckoning. And I've been anxious to catch up with her. I confess I have not yet had a chance to see the film, but I am excited to do so and even more excited to have a chance to talk with you a bit about it. Cindy, thank you for joining us here at Securing America.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
So the starting point for me of this reckoning is that not only were we afflicted by the Chinese biological warfare attack of this so-called SARS-CoV-2 virus, better known as the COVID-19 pandemic virus, but we also got the full China model of how to contend with it imposed upon us as well. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, as the sort of predicate for the reckoning that you believe needs to take place now.
Sure. Well, as we know, the virus came from China, and so did the lockdown model. When things first started happening in China, everyone wanted to know more. Finally, it took a while. There was a WHO/China organized trip to China to see what happened. That was in mid-February 2020. There were 23 delegates that went on this, half of them were Chinese. So this was billed as independent of their countries, independent of the agencies that sent them. They were, you know, from the US, from Germany, from Japan, South Korea, several different countries were there. And they went on this trip and they were there about 6 days, I think. And they, you know, they were taken around and shown things and spoke to, you know, scientists and et cetera, et cetera. Came back with a report that they unanimously signed off on. They coordinated with everything that was in the report. They unanimously signed off on it. And what they said was that China had this big problem. There was this virus and they had to do these severe lockdowns, but through, you know, lockdowns and contact tracing and, you know, all these other mitigation measures, lo and behold, they really solved the problem. And, you know, the curve, you know, had been going like this, and then it took a sharp down in a way that naturally wouldn't have happened. And they did it through their policies. And therefore, we should follow those policies. Exactly. And they came back, this was mid-February, they came back, issued the report on February 28th. And also to note, at the same time, there had been, remember, Italy was the first other country, you know, to have a really big outbreak. Well, Iran but Italy didn't go into like a strict lockdown. And so there were two models now. We could look at Italy and be like, oh my goodness, look, it's exploding. The hospital's overwhelmed. Look at China. They have everything under control. But I have in the piece a clip from the press conference of the lead doctor on that trip. And he was asked why he wasn't wearing a mask, or I think even quarantining, since he had just gotten back from China. And his answer was, oh no, we were very careful. We didn't meet any patients. We didn't, you know, interact with any contacts or contacts of contacts. I was like, so what did you see firsthand? Or did you just buy whatever CCP was selling you, you know? So that set the stage.
It's my understanding, in addition to the Chinese nationals who were obviously under control of the Chinese party, but you also had a bunch of other medical personnel who weren't too independent either, as it happens, compromised in some cases by their own direct involvement in some of these gain-of-function experiments and so on. But we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about, Cindy, and I did want to just give you a chance to talk a bit about the things that we need a reckoning for as a result of this China model having been applied, the lockdowns, the mask mandates, the quarantines, the vaccines in the middle of a pandemic, especially these experimental mRNA vaccines, as they're called, and what we've learned from their mandates and efforts to enforce those mandates, notably through things like this vaccine passport business.
Well, there's a lot of things that need to be reckoned with. You know, my story starts with Jeffrey Tucker, who founded the Brownstone Institute, explicitly to document, investigate, ask questions around, you know, what's happened to us over the last 2 years. And he starts by offering a lot of questions that maybe people haven't thought about. For example, like, why was it in a federalist country that every school in the country, you know, locked down at the same time? Every hospital stopped treating, virtually every hospital stopped treating anyone but COVID patients. All of these things went into effect. All HR departments around the country got the same document about who is essential worker and who's not. How did all that get generated? Who signed off on it? Who wrote it? How did it get, you know, how did that happen in our, you know, federalist country? So there's a bunch of questions like that. Plus, once, you know, why wasn't there any change? Why weren't economists, why wasn't anyone else consulted to talk about the, you know, the collateral damage, the costs and benefits to the lockdowns?
Specifically, the failure to get the early treatments available instead of this emergency use of these exotic and, it seems, somewhat dangerous vaccines. So the reckoning that you're talking about is really a cost impact as well as the societal impact, no?
There's everything. I mean, there's the psychic impact, there's the societal impact, there's kids that have lost, you know, the whole schools thing is, you know, kids have lost school for a year or 2 years. We're going to be seeing the repercussions of that for, you know, years and years to come. so many things, all the missed, you know, cancer screening and all those missed appointments that we've talked about. So there's a lot of things that need to be reckoned with. And why didn't they change course when new information came to light, when it was clear that the vaccines weren't stopping transmission or getting disease? Why still the mandates? Many, many questions need to be answered in this reckoning.
Yeah. And one of the things that, as you've documented, I understand, in the films, is that the impact on our liberty, more generally, our freedom of speech, for example. I mean, you asked the question rhetorically there. One of the reasons there weren't course corrections, it seems, is that everybody's efforts to, you know, promote such ideas were being aggressively suppressed. No?
Exactly. And it seemed that, you know, government, big tech, media, from the people I talked to, you know, everything was in lockstep. Why weren't more voices at the table? I speak to Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who, of course, is one of the authors of the Great Barrington Declaration, who was advocating for, you know, focused protection instead of everybody getting locked down. Why weren't their voices listened to, or others who had anything else to say except, you know, what they decided very early on was, you know, the official line on how they were going to go about combating this. I also, another doctor I spoke to, Dr. Steve Templeton, he makes a good point, you know, that the all of the language and messaging around it was, you know, this war and we've got to fight the battle. And of course that introduces ideas that we can win, but, you know, it's a virus, it's going to be around. He's like, much better would have been natural disaster, you know, kind of, you know, imagery or language to talk about it with. There's so many things that just don't make sense that need to be answered if we're going to hope to do things differently, you know, the next time around.
This is the key point, of course. Cindy Drucker, and your two-part study of this, of the pandemic's wake, you call the first section, and the charting the future, brings us to the point that I'd like to conclude with, and that is, what do you think are the most important takeaways about what we did wrong in this case, and that we must never allow to be done to us again, especially if we seek to have the country that we love preserved and going forward, a going concern?
Well, I think the most important thing touched on is not to curtail everyone's liberties, and most importantly, freedom of speech. Because, you know, things that we now know to be true were completely censored, you know, on social media. You could lose your Twitter account, your, you know, you have your YouTube channel taken down for things, for example, talking about the possibility that it leaked from a lab in Wuhan, you know, but so many things, you know, along the way. So one of the main things is there has to be a diversity of voices and not a shutting down of discussion. That's probably the biggest, but another part of it is reckoning within professions themselves is something we talk about. So within the, you know, economists, within the, you know, public health policy sector, like, why didn't more people speak up in those sectors? If you spoke up, you know, it became dangerous and you were shut down. But most of the people in those professions should have been realizing there were problems.
Cindy, there's so much more to talk about, but we're hard out of time. How do people get access to these really important two films about the reckoning and COVID-19?
Yeah, this is an NTD television production, so you can find us on ntd.com and just search for The Nation Speaks, or we're also on epochtv.com. Again, just search for The Nation Speaks, and they're the most two recent episodes.
Wonderful. Thank you for hosting The Nation Speaks and for sharing some of the insights from this important work with us. I hope you'll keep us updated in future editions of what you're doing. Cindy Drucker, keep up the great work, my dear. I want to say thank you before I run out of time to our hosts here in Dallas, fabulous people, Russell Lake and Kevin Freeman of the Economic War Room team, who've made it possible for us to do our remote broadcasting this week from Dallas. I'm always very grateful for their time, their expertise, and their great hospitality. And I thank you for joining us. We're going to come back next with Bill Marshall from Judicial Watch about three fantastically important topics you want to know about. It's hard work there at Judicial Watch. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. There may be a worse time for Joe Biden to pay a visit to the Middle East, but it is hard to think of one. The government of Israel has just fallen. Its parliament disbanded in the fifth round of elections in 3 years, called for October. The Biden team has been emboldening the Palestinians to engage in renewed violence. Jordan's kingdom is hanging by a thread, and the likelihood of conflict with Iran seems to be growing by the moment. There is literally no chance that President Biden's presence will improve matters. His team has fostered regional instability by subverting Israel, appeasing Iran's mullahs, and simultaneously undermining Saudi Arabia and asking it to increase oil production. China and Russia are making regional inroads at our expense. It's in the vital interests of the United States for Joe Biden to stay home. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and one of the people that we have the privilege of visiting with from time to time to take stock of the whole host of issues that he works on at a terrific organization in Washington, D.C., Judicial Watch, is Bill Marshall. He is a highly accomplished 30-year professional in the intelligence and investigations space, both in government and in the private sector. He's now in charge of their investigative work at Judicial Watch, and it's, of course, about as good as there is anywhere in the country. It's always good to visit with him, and Bill, this is no exception. Welcome back to Securing America, my friend.
Well, thanks for having me back, Frank. It's an amazing time to be alive in America, for sure.
It is, and you are in a very prominent position to take stock at what is amazing about it, and in some cases very alarming about what's happening in and to our country. One of the things that you've been working on, Bill, is the degree to which the United States government funded the gain of function research that seems to have contributed materially to this, well, I think, biological warfare attack by the Chinese Communist Party against our country. We have a new report coming out next week on the subject, and I'm very keen to hear what your research has come up with in this regard.
Right. Well, one of my colleagues, Chris Nelson, and I have really been focusing on this issue quite a bit. And you may have seen some of our previous stories, some of which I've done, some of which Chris has done, discussing the funding by the NIAID, this is Anthony Fauci's shop, within the NIH, in which they dispense literally hundreds of millions of dollars, at least, perhaps billions, in the for this research that's called gain of function research, and essentially it is changing the genetics of viruses to make them more virulent and more transmissible. Okay, there's been great debate within the scientific community, the medical community, as to the merits of this research. They claim, well, they need to do this in order to create new vaccines. To my mind, it seems counterintuitive. And essentially what they're doing is creating monster viruses, potentially lethal viruses. And one of the stories that actually Chris did recently discusses records that he got regarding incidents that were reported to NIH of accidents and mishaps in these I would call them biological weapons facilities, but we'll just say biosafety labs in which they are using like CRISPR gene editing technology and, you know, recombinant DNA and serial passaging viruses to make them more deadly, essentially. And we got reports of like at least 100 incidents of mishaps occurring in these labs. And it's just stunning to me. In the United States, yes, to be clear, that's in the United States. And that's at a bare minimum is what I'm guessing. But this is what we were able to cull out of email traffic that Chris obtained. And it's really just amazing stuff. You know, the University of Nebraska, there was a scientist who was working on an HIV pseudovirus containing a Marburg protein. Marburg virus is another deadly virus. So they're creating these Frankensteinian viruses, which have the potential to wreak havoc on society.
And besides all of that, I mean, that's bad enough, heavens knows. But what was now, I guess, documented by NIH responses to Freedom of Information Act requests and the like is that we did a lot to train the Chinese Communist Party's biological warfare program. And no kidding, a biological warfare program, I think is the only way to describe it, to use these techniques, no?
Yes. And as I think we've discussed before, Frank, Xi Jiang Li, I believe it is, the bat lady, the Wuhan, the infamous bat lady who ran the lab in Wuhan that many have thought leaked this virus, was trained by Professor Ralph Baric, you know, one of these geniuses of gain-of-function research who are at the University of North Carolina. And in fact, as we detail in this particular report that Chris wrote, there were a couple of incidents, mishaps at the UNC labs, one of which was a spillage of a virus, and another one in which you had a mouse, an infected mouse, biting one of the researchers. So these things are going on all over the country. Again, my astonishment is that we haven't been devastated by one of these killer viruses already, just due to a human error.
We're on borrowed time, I suspect, and it's one of the reasons why this whole program was supposed to have been shut down, and that seemed to have been part of why Tony Fauci moved it to China, was to avoid, you know, the Obama years' efforts to have a moratorium on this stuff. Bill, we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about. I did want to turn to another hot topic, namely the January 6th committee is holding much publicized hearings these days. They're not focused on some things that you have been looking into, though. Talk about the murder of Ashley Babbitt. You know, it's often said there was it was a lethal insurrection. Well, this was the extent of the lethality was this Air Force veteran was murdered by a police officer. What have you found in your research? And we may have to get just a minute here and then we'll take a quick break and we'll be right back with more on it.
Right. Exactly. I had filed after her death, I had filed a FOIA request with Metropolitan Police Department, DOJ, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Civil Rights Division of DOJ. Anyway, we've been getting a steady, you know, stream of records from these various agencies, which have revealed increasingly the really outrageous conduct, I would argue, of Lieutenant Michael Byrd of the U.S. Capitol Police, who killed her. One of my colleagues, as you and I have discussed, is a retired Phoenix police officer and an expert in use of force and in police disciplinary procedures. He had been a union representative, so he in Phoenix for the police. So he's very familiar with all this.
Bill, hold the thought because I want you to give us his full insight into what the practice was supposed to be and what actually happened in this event in which Ashley Babbitt was murdered in cold blood, I believe, in the course of this so-called insurrection. That and more with Bill Marshall of Judicial Watch, straight ahead. Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation with Bill Marshall, Chief Investigator of Judicial Watch, one of the most formidable organizations in the United States, trying to ascertain the truth about so many issues on which the public has a need to know. And one of them is the matter we're discussing with Bill at the moment, namely the murder of Ashley Babbitt by a police officer in the course of the January 6th events in the Capitol. And Bill, you were talking about a colleague of yours who has a lot of experience in professional conduct in situations like this. Tell us about his assessment of what happened that day and the consequences of it.
Right. I'm referring to Mark Spencer, great, great guy, great investigator and former retired police officer who's dealt with many of these use of force issues in the line in his previous line of work. And he and I, now I also have some law enforcement background and I'm somewhat familiar with these issues as well, but he even more so. And we both concluded that this shooting was absolutely unjustified. There were all of the police witnesses, and we've got all these records. We've got all the witness statements through from both DOJ and Metropolitan Police Department in D.C. indicate that all the witnesses saw there was nothing in Ashley Babbitt's hands. Now, use of force guidelines always will direct an officer to use the minimum force necessary to subdue a suspect. In this case, she has nothing in her hands. She's a small woman. I believe she's like 5'1", maybe 110 pounds, something like this. And you have this large, very experienced, presumably U.S. Capitol Police Lieutenant Michael Byrd, supervisory officer. He uses as his first line of defense, rather than his hands to physically subdue her, take her to the ground, he pulls out his service weapon and shoots her in below the left clavicle. The bullet traverses her chest, severing various arteries and internal organs and killing her within minutes. And he reportedly, according to some witnesses, didn't even give her a warning. Now, there's some debate about that. And look, I will be the first to defend police actions. I understand it's a very difficult job. They have to make split decisions. But when you're looking at a situation like this, your first thought should be you're not only endangering the person that you're aiming at, which is obviously intentional, but you're endangering people that may be behind her if that had been a through and through shooting. So this is it was a
crowded space.
It was a very crowded space. It was really an egregious,
including police officers, as I recall.
Yes, it was an egregious decision on Byrd's part to use this method to take her down, and then he did not follow the Capitol Police use of force guidelines, which we have and which we will be publishing, which indicate that. That he was required to file a certain form, a written form, as all Capitol Police officers are following use of force incident. And he did not do this. And he says in his, he admitted to officers that he did not file this form. Well, why wasn't he disciplined for that failure, or if not prosecuted for violating her civil rights?
As I understand it, that's typically a firing offense in police.
Yes. Well, under something called the Garrity Warning, he was required to give a statement pertaining to his actions. And if he refused to, this is my understanding, and I want to caveat that by saying Mark is much more fluent in this area, but my understanding is that for failing to give an official statement regarding his actions, he should have been terminated by the U.S. Capitol Police. But he got off with a slap on the wrist, and actually, he was given accolades by
Indeed.
Members of Congress for his actions.
Indeed, honored for his conduct. Bill, one last item before we let you go: you have a graduate, as I understand it, of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point in your family, and therefore a special interest in some research that you've been doing into the kind of indoctrination that's taking place at that service academy, and I understand the others as well. Tell us about it and what you found that's very troubling indeed.
Yes, my son is a West Point graduate, and we were receiving information from our supporters, who are many of them, obviously, we have some West Point graduates, We have great patriotic followers. And they were warning us about CRT, critical race theory training that was being taught at West Point. Now, this shocked me, as my son had never mentioned in the years that he was there, but he, you know, he graduated before, I guess, probably all of this CRT stuff was really being introduced in a big way. But we sued on one of my requests to West Point for any PowerPoints, any instructional, you know, training material that was being used to train West Point cadets on critical race theory. And they also asked for the communications of the four senior leaders within West Point about CRT. It was interesting. We got a lot of great in quote records, including PowerPoints. But the emails, interestingly, were almost all entirely redacted. Now, they claim, you know, deliberative process. They use certain FOIA exemptions to get around. And I, frankly, I highly question the validity of those exemptions. But putting that aside, even the PowerPoint presentations we got were disgusting. I mean, Frank, these materials are, the CRT stuff is so poisonous that it's designed to divide this country and make our, in this case, military officers, the leaders of our army, despise the very country that they are sworn to defend and to put their lives on the line. Yes, you know, they talk about whiteness, white people and people of color live racially different structured lives. Goes into, you know, critical race theory grows out of the field of law. This is one of the quotes in one of their slides. Critical race theory grows out of the field of law and studies the way that racism is built into each. Ways that racism is built into and reproduced through the institutions that organize everyday life in America.
Bill, this is so troubling. And unfortunately, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but we're going to come back to it with you because it's so clearly at odds with the mission of the military to defend this country and to have unit cohesion and readiness. And I can only think of it as just another example of the kind of wrecking operation that we've seen mounted against our people, our institutions, our country, our Constitution. Thanks for the great work you do at Judicial Watch to try to protect all of those. Bill, come back to us with updates as soon as possible, if you would. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station, for more of what you can do to protect the country we love. And I hope you will then go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.